Welcome, and thanks a lot for coming to this, which is the 11th out of 12 in the current summer series of Digital Classicist and Institute of Classical Studies Work in Progress seminars. We're here, we have to put a plug to our sponsors. The Centre for Computing Humanities and the Institute of Classical Studies have provided most of the refreshments that will be coming out afterwards and so forth. There are various flyers helping to fulfill these responsibilities, advertising these various sponsors around the tables. You should also find a couple of flyers for the next and last seminar next week, which will be Peter Heslin from Durham talking about Diogenes, which is a piece of software for reading the TLG and PHI CD-ROMs that some of you may have come across. He'll be talking about past development and future plans with that software. Just a few words about the Digital Classicist. For those of you who haven't been to these seminars before, the Digital Classicist, which runs and sponsors these seminars, is an organization basically pulling together and promoting collaboration between scholars at various levels who are interested in the study of the ancient world and especially in collaboration with or with the use of computer science scholarship and the use of cyber infrastructure and similar technologies. We're very pleased this week to have someone who's presenting work that really is in progress. Yanis Doukas is a master's student in the art department in the Center for Computing Humanities at King's. And his background is in classics. He has a BA and a master's from Athens, and is now taking a master's in digital humanities at King's. And the work he's going to be talking about today is one aspect of work coming out of his master's dissertation, which is on digital publication and Homer. And he's going to talk to us today about, or he's going to present some ideas towards a digital publication for the Homeric catalog of ships.
Thanks, Jan. Hello all, thanks for coming. This paper stems from work on my dissertation, which will be a digital publication for the Homeric Catalogue of Ships. Today I shall focus on the objectives and the projected results of my research and on the methods and techniques I intend to use towards them. This will be discussed in relation both to the subject matter of the research, the text of the Catalogue of Ships from Homer's Iliad, and to its form, which is a commentary as adapted to the nature of the digital medium and to the needs of a diverse audience ranging from academic researchers approaching the text and concentrating on various of its elements to readers seeking to enhance their experience by translating words into visual and encyclopedic information. Let us first present the text itself. The Catalogue of Ships comes midway through the second book of the Iliad. The first book features the quarrel between Agamemnon and Achilles, and the latter's request to his mother Thetis to intervene so that the gods of Olympus assist the Trojans. The second book begins with a dream sent by Zeus to Agamemnon to deceive him into thinking that he can win the war on that day, and the unfortunate attempt of the general to test the morale of his soldiers by proposing to abandon the siege of Troy and return home. This is accepted with enthusiasm, and they promptly run to the shore. Odysseus, however, manages to bring them back, and after his and Nestor's rousing speeches, the army is finally led to the battlefield. At that point begins the text we are dealing with, the proem, with the poet appealing to the muses for help, enhances the importance of what is to follow. The first verse of the proem is a formula, repeated in its entirety an additional three times in the Iliad, all of them when the poet has to undertake a difficult task of battle narrative, and many more in part or in variations within the corpus of Greek epic poetry. What follows is 265 verses of a list including 29 contingents, 44 leaders, 175 named towns or other localities, 1,186 ships, and according to a plausible calculation, about 100,000 men. Our catalogue is the most famous example of this narrative method, which expanded to individual works such as the Hesiodic Catalogue of Women. It offers a compendium of mythological prosopography and a structured geographical panorama of the Greek world. All this, however, not without issues. The catalogue has a long history of reception, criticism and related scholarship. Homeric geography has been a controversial subject since antiquity. Early on, two tendencies developed. The one skeptical or altogether dismissive of the reliability and factuality of information included in the epics, and the other taking them as handbooks of history and geography. Homer and the poems have a strong presence in geographical works with hundreds of quotations from and references to Homer, mostly in Strabo and Pausanias. Strabo recognized Homer as the founder of geography and also records and rejects the rival view expressed by Eratosthenes that the aim of every poet is to entertain, not to instruct. The main two questions about the catalogue of ships are related to content and authorship. On the one hand, it has been discussed whether the geographical information provided is accurate or not, and if yes, then which is the Greece depicted as far as chronology is concerned. On the other hand, practically raising the whole Homeric question, as Thomas Allen noted, there is the subject of the incorporation of the text into the epic, that is to say, whether it was a genuine part of the composition. If not, was it an older narrative included in the poem, or a later interpolation designed to accommodate local ambitions? The turning point in scholarship was the archaeological finds since the 19th century. Few would now dispute that there is a kernel of historical truth in the Homeric poems. The excavations brought to light a historical world, which had to be taken into consideration in any related discussion. In this new context, Thomas Allen dedicated a 30-page article to the catalogue in 1910. He would later come back to the text in 1921 with a more extensive commentary, in which he concluded that it describes a period once existent in reality, namely the period to which it purports to belong, the pre-Dorian heroic age, and that it is a historical document giving us a correct picture of Greece at the moment when war was declared upon Ilium. He also argued that it dated from the Achaean period, being part of a verse chronicle, which served as the basis for the construction of the Iliad and the Odyssey, and explained the inconsistencies between the catalogue and the rest of the epics by assuming that the epic poet took many liberties with the material he worked on, but transmitted with religious scruple the list of men and ships. 5 years later, however, Walter Leaf maintained that the inconsistencies are irreconcilable and that the catalogue must have been the creation of someone, probably a historian, who wanted to include obscure heroes and places in the Trojan saga. Allen discussed these issues again in 1921, and a bitter and passionate debate ensued between the two in the pages of the Classical Review. It goes without saying that issues remained unsolved. The passing of time, though, brought new archaeological finds and with them more sober approaches. According to Dennis Page, the catalogue reflects Mycenaean rather than post-Mycenaean Greece, and embodies this tradition in a purer form than the rest of the Iliad. Since the poem is the final product of a continuous development over a very long period of time, whereas the catalogue, being essentially nothing but a list of names, has naturally changed comparatively little throughout the same period. Moreover, as Holmes, Simpson and Lazenby highlighted in 1970, of those places which have been excavated, none has so far failed to produce evidence of Mycenaean occupation. Therefore, we can probably assume that the lost places are not fictitious. They also set the research priority straight when they underlined that it is dangerous to argue from what the catalogue does not say. Rather, we should look at what it does say about Greece. The latest major contribution to the subject is Edzard Wieser's commentary, which was published in 1997. In his approach, he concluded that the catalogue could be an integral part of the Iliad, as far as the technique of its composition is concerned, that its elements come from the Mycenaean times, transferred into the epic by heroic myths, and that these elements are treated as real rather than fictitious. Emphasis was especially put on places of mythological importance, even if they were not a part of the geopolitical reality in Homer's time. Based on these opinions and for the needs of our work here, we consider that the Catalogue of Ships is a text coming from the pre-Homeric epic tradition and that its source must be dated in the Mycenaean era. It describes the political and geographical reality of this era, but it does so in the way literary texts do. So the question is not why there are inconsistencies with what we consider as the accurate geography of the historical Greek world, but why there shouldn't be. The catalogue does not purport to be a documentary text. The information it provides is nonetheless valuable, and we can use it to address research questions on and beyond the text. We shall now proceed to analyze this information and to examine what kind of questions it raises and solves. Two are the quintessential elements of the catalogue on which we intend to concentrate: personal and place names. On the one hand, we are dealing with the listing of a generation of heroes who are set in the context of their origin and within a Pan-Hellenic confederation. Taking into consideration the fact that Greek mythology was not based on a Bible of some sort and was instead transmitted in the form of an oral popular tradition, both before and after the composition of the Homeric poems, it becomes evident that with the catalogue we get a combination of local variations towards the development of a new consciousness of the past. Throughout antiquity, the Greek cities built and reaffirmed their identity on uses of this past, and in that process the key factors were the philotimia, that is to say, the emulous desire to keep up with the mythical exploits of the local heroes, and the euphemia, the praise, which was provided by literary texts such as the Homeric ones. That, combined with the central position that the epics held in education and cultural life, shows that the catalogue of ships is an indispensable tool for the study of mythology because of its content and the width of its reception. Furthermore, the quantity of the personal names in the text allows us to explore questions in the field of onomastics. We can examine if the names of the heroes are attested in common usage, which are more frequent, and whether there exists a causality between the local distribution of the names and the origin of the heroes, thus unveiling aspects of the hero cult in the cities, which was always an important part of their religious life. Even more important are the numerous place names in the catalogue of ships. These appear in a consciously ordered list corresponding to the geography of the Greek world. The contingents are separated into five zones, following in part a spiral clockwise movement in the narrative. These zones are central Greece, from the Isthmus of Corinth up to Mount Ita, the Peloponnese, the Ionian Islands and Western Greece, the Aegean Sea and Greece north of Mount Ita. Not all the place names in the catalogue can be identified as actual places which have been inhabited in historical times and or excavated in modern ones. This must not surprise us, given that the period between the events described in the epics and the time of their composition, the so-called Greek Dark Ages, must have been, as far as we can deduce, a time of turmoil, depopulation and migrations. Therefore, some settlements could have been abandoned, others renamed. This seems more plausible if we consider that these phenomena occur even in relatively peaceful periods. By this train of thought, we mean to say that for us each place name in the catalogue translates into a real locality, and with that come the related real research questions. The obvious primary use of this data is geographical. As we have already said, geographical writing, from its very beginnings, held Homer and the catalogue as a point of reference. Moving from these early forms of periegesis, which was a descriptive narrative of leading ground and explaining what was worth notice, onto geography as a composite modern discipline, constantly expanding its own subject matter and being redefined by the coming of the digital age, we see that the catalogue is always a text offering itself as source material to promote that kind of study and to avail from developed tools and interdisciplinary practices. Our place names are naturally set under a historical diachronic perspective covering every possible aspect of the geographical science. Some basic applications we can think of are toponymy, which is the scientific, especially linguistic, study of place names, and cartography, the map making. Apart from this, the data in the catalogue of ships can fit into any other approach of antiquity that is based on a specific locality or a group of localities. We can imagine thus the historian, the Bronze Age archaeologist, or the paleographer who might work with provenance-based corpora of Liner B tablets or epigraphs, turn to the text and include it in their studies. For this reason, it is necessary to create a publication able to accommodate the needs of this manifold research. Essentially, what we want to do is to perform a digital close reading on the text, based on the elements we refer to, in order to explain and elucidate them. Ever since antiquity, commentaries, in the form of marginal scholia, aimed at the better understanding of text, which had become partly or wholly obscure with the passing of time. Nowadays, more than ever, that classical literature has no longer a dominant role in the curriculum. A different audience has to be reached, and for that, new structures to be built, new methods applied, new conventions agreed. Identifying thus the prospective users of our publication as researchers who are interested in specific types of data and ways of manipulating it, and readers coming from non-classicist backgrounds who attempt to approach and understand the text, we shall now analyze how we intend to structure and display the text and the supplementary information about it. Before we do that, however, we should recognize the obvious and note that although we shall build on highlighting documentary elements of the text, still the catalogue of SIPs is primarily the subject of philological study in the many levels that exist, from the basic lexical one on to more general literary criticism, study of textual transmission and reception, to name but a few. So first, let us take the time and refer to what we shall not do for this project, mostly because it is or will be adequately covered in others. For instance, someone who wants to follow the text word by word, focusing on grammar and vocabulary, should turn to the Perseus Digital Library. There, each word of the Greek text is linked to a pop-up word study tool, which offers a parse, dictionary entries, and frequency statistics. In the case of the Iliad, we get the original text in the Oxford Classical Text Editions, two English translations, and Walter Leaf commentary. It is of special interest to us that several, but not all, place names in Butler's text are tagged as such and extracted to a list, from which each one is cross-referenced to a name entity browser, featuring all its occurrences in the corpus. All in all, Perseus is a tool that enables even a beginner in ancient Greek to follow the text and get an insight in its structure. These possibilities are broadened by a project such as the Chicago Homer. This is a project hosted at the Northwestern University, edited by Ahuvia Kahan and Martin Mueller. Here our text is set in the context of early Greek epic and can be displayed along with English and German translations. The objective of the project is to make the distinctive feature of early Greek epic accessible to readers with and without Greek by using the search and display capabilities of electronic texts. The component parts of this project are the standard electronic editions of the texts encoded in standard generalized markup language, English and German translations that closely observe the line structure of the originals, a set of tables that support lexical, phrasal, morphological, and narratological searches, and a web-based user interface that gives access to the texts and supports queries to the database. The most distinctive feature of the Chicago Homer is the repeated phrase markers, which identify all the instances where a sequence or two or more words are repeated in the corpus, not only the formula. Based on the idiom principle, according to which a language user has available to him or her a large number of semi-preconstructed phrases that constitute single choices, even though they might appear to be analyzable into segments, the editors consider that the Homeric question is actually a question about phrasal repetition, and that the repeated phrase markers enables the modern reader to simulate the competence of the ancient listener, since repeated phrases would resonate with the context of their occurrences elsewhere. It could be argued that the catalogue of SIPs is, in its entirety, a combination of formulaic verses repeated from earlier epic compositions. Therefore, this feature is of great importance for our text. Finally, another meaningful issue in the history of the textual transmission is the history of the textual transmission. This is addressed, or rather will be, by the Homer Multitext Project. This is hosted by the Center of Hellenic Studies of Harvard University. The project involves a multi-institutional group of 28 researchers led by the editors Casey Due and Mary Ebbott and the information architects Christopher Blackwell and Neil Smith. The Homer Multitext Project uses open source standards for digital publications and offers free access to a library of text and images, a machine interface to that library and its indices, and tools to allow readers to discover and engage with the Homeric tradition. The goal of the project is to present the textual transmission of the Iliad and Odyssey in a historical framework. This framework is considered necessary to understand the changes in the medium of oral performance as they are reflected in the many texts of Homer in many and different historical contexts. These contexts are to be viewed both synchronically and diachronically. The evolution of the textual tradition covers a period longer than 1,000 years, from the pre-classical up to the medieval era. Essentially, the multi-text Homer is a critical edition. Being, however, electronic and web-based, it does not offer a supposedly reconstructed original text, as printed editions do, but instead a series of tools for the user to reconstruct a variety of texts in a variety of places and times. So it embraces the fluidity of the textual traditions of the Iliad and Odyssey in order to establish a prototype for developing holistic and historically contextualized approaches to ancient texts. The electronic medium is used to present the information in a way that is more intuitive for the reader, more transparent in showing the multiple sources, and more true to the textual and oral traditions of the poetry. The multi-text is still a project in progress. For the time being, the published part of the project is the scanned images of 3 manuscripts of the Iliad from the Marciana Library of Venice. Those of you who attended Brett Seale's seminar in June will remember his discussion of the scanning process. The scanned images can be accessed through an image directory. Also, a manuscript browser can be used in order to retrieve either a page of the manuscripts by passage citation or by reference to a particular folio of a manuscript. Another project related to the textual transmission of the poems is Homer and the Papyri, created by Professor Dana Sutton, who published it in CD-ROM and later on the web. In its first edition, it included lists of published Homeric papyri, divided into 3 categories: papyri containing the actual text of the epics, glossaries and scholia minora under the name of Homerica, and Homeric quotations in non-Homeric papyri. It also included a repertoire of textual variants presented in this papyri. In 2001, the project was handed over to the Center of Hellenic Studies and the project team led by Gregory Nudge. It was then published in a second electronic edition as a fully researchable relational database of Homeric papyri. In the search interface, which you can see in the PowerPoint, the user may search for variants or witnesses by specifying one or more of the following fields: title, book, line, variant, witness, and description. These papyrological sources can also be accessed through the Leuven database of ancient books, which includes records of 13,000 published literary papyri. Of these, the Homeric ones are a substantial part, larger than of any other authors. Having discussed these projects, which cover important aspects of digital research on the Homeric text, we move on to what we actually plan to do. We are going to create a file in TIXML. The extensible markup language is ideal for this project. Markup is adding a level of information to the text, from the simplest formatting and structural information up to the tagging of specific words, cross-referencing and commentary in the form of historical, philological and physical description. Moreover, since the digital landscape is ever-changing and new resources are being developed all the time, we need a publication that will accommodate these changes and conform to the needs of its audience. XML is flexible, it is an open standard and relatively human legible, so our final output will be available for expansions and alterations from each according to his ability to each according to his need, so to speak. Once the XML file is complete, we shall use Extensible Styleset Language Transformations, XSLT, to transform it into the final HTML documents. Although we shall write a single XML file, the XSLT script will process and create multiple HTML files, one for each of the 29 contingents of the catalog. We found ourselves now to the key part of our project, the treatment of the personal and place names. Obviously, this will be tagged as such in the XML file and cross-referenced to related resources. Ideally, this project would include the building of new resources on mythology and geography based on the date of the catalog of ships. However, this would go beyond a dissertation, so we shall have to do with what exists today. The personal names will be linked with limata in the Dizionario Etimologico della Mitologia Greca, developed by the Gruppo di Ricerca sul Mito e la Mitografia of the University of Trieste. This resource is available in Italian, Spanish and French and is still under construction. Thankfully, each of the limata has an ID attached to it and a stable URL. This is unfortunately unavailable for the time being in the lexicon of Greek personal names, which is our resource for onomastics. There is a pattern that can be followed in order to extract from the database all occurrences of a name and use them for our research, but the website used is not always online. The place names will be connected to the Pleiades project, which is a joint undertaking of the Ancient World Mapping Center at the University of North Carolina, the Institute for the Study of Ancient World at New York University, and the STOA Consortium at the University of Kentucky, aiming to provide online access to all information about Greek and Roman geography assembled by the Classical Atlas Project for the Barrington Atlas of the Greek and Roman World, and also to enhance and expand this data. Again, each of the places in the Pleiades project will have a stable identifier attached to it, although for the time being only places from Asia Minor and North Africa have such identifiers and have been put online. Another geographical resource which can be used, especially in order to underline the archaeological aspect of the place names, is Metis, created by Bruce Halger and also hosted by the STOA Consortium. Finally, we could also build a KML file with all the place names and embed it in the pages with Google Maps or Google Earth. Another question we face is related not only with the possibilities, but also with the limitations of the annotation for a text. Although commentaries and supplementary resources are necessary for the understanding of the texts, there is always the danger for them to work as distractions and eventually come between the text and the reader instead of bringing them together. For this project, we are thinking of adding only two more: a bibliography on the catalogue of ships, linked to from the homepage of our publication, and a link from every verse citation to Eumeos, which is an associated collaborative website designed to extend the Chicago Homer, described as an embryonic digital variorum offering the following elements: papyrus readings from Homer and the Papyri, scholia from Erebus's edition, correspondences between the Iliad and the Aeneid, bibliographical items from Lanet Philologique, and notes and reports on Homeric repetitions. That's about it.
Well, okay, maybe I'll ask this question afterwards, probably. Okay, thanks very much. I just had a very small question about the last item you mentioned, Eumaios. Are the URLs of the individual items inside Eumaios stable?
There is a stable URL which can link directly from a verse citation to.
Right.
There is a URL for each verse.
Okay. Right.
So it can be linked quite easily.
Right. Okay. Because I mean that was quite an important point in terms of the implementation of this. You can point to several of these sites because they have IDs, published IDs, and stable URLs that are generated from those IDs.
Mm-hmm.
But not the one of those that you're not currently able to do was the lexicon of Greek personal names.
There is a way to do it, but
the
website is currently not online. It was
That's
online. It will
That's
be probably
site,
it's something under construction. So
eventually,
it's
stable, because it's on the development site.
But the point is to create something flexible that can be implemented, and new resources are created all the time. So
absolutely. Were there any other questions?
Yeah, I have an obvious one. Sorry. Yanis, that was great. Thank you. Remember that project for your dissertation. What is it you're actually going to be handing in for your dissertation? Are you actually going to be doing a prototype for this?
Yeah, I'll, as soon as this is over, yeah, and after the pub,
very ambitious.
After the pub. Tomorrow, maybe.
Okay, so
yeah, but it will be an XML file that will be a publication, and hopefully when it's over it will be published in the digital classes website, so it can be available for everyone to play around with it, download it, and
I have some more, but I would
just for clarification, I'm not sure I understood how the onomastic research is going to work. Do I have a link to the lexicon of Greek personal names?
Yes,
so
as
when
soon
you,
as
you
it,
check
it
out
will
the
be able
name,
to
you will link to that and see what happens.
Each of the place names each of the personal names will be tagged as a personal name, and since in the database of the lexicon of Greek personal names there is a record for Philoctetes, for example, then Philoctetes in the text of in the XML text will be linked to the records in the database, and so just by clicking on the name, we'll get the database records of the lexicon.
Right. Is it what, which will show who else was called by that name?
Yeah,
right.
Just common people named Philoctetes, and we'll see if there is any combination, any relation. Are the Philoctetes in the ancient Greek world come from the same place as the mythical
right.
Philoctetes, or is it?
I mean, you mentioned that the site, the test site that the lexicon used for that data is not currently available.
I think
when Sebastian gave a paper in this series about 10 weeks ago now, he showed that site, and what one of the things they were able to do was to take a text, and he picked a text, one of our online texts from Aphrodisias, which had a couple of hundred names in it, and showed that not doing anything to the text, but simply linking every personal name in it that was already marked up by our project to their site, he was simply able to create a pop-up that appeared when you hovered over the name, which gave you the it gave you a count and a date range for that name, but it could also then link to a geographical spread for that name, and the geographical spread linked to the date information on the individual name. So it was able to then be plotted on, for example, a time map, a map with a timeline to show how the name moved around at various times. And so, yeah, I mean, they could be.
The same could be done.
That sort of thing could be done. Yeah, I mean, it's a powerful resource. It's a shame they haven't got that aspect of it, stable with URLs that you could use in time for this project. But as you say,
it can be released.
That does sound very interesting. What by Churubax is possible to tell us about the catalogue, how it will help us the catalogue of ships, because I guess pretty much all of that, sort of what you get on the lexicon, will be significantly later, by several centuries. So it might tell us that people in Argos and Beta Homer and the Dionysus from Argos called their sons that. Or is there any other way that this can help our understanding of the catalogue as such?
The main, apart from the onomastics, the other main aspect is an etymological dictionary. So it's the idea of how a reader reading the catalogue of ships and probably knowing nothing about all these heroes and who they were and where they came from, it can give him the kind of understanding a commentary can give, but in a digital form. And mainly that. Apart from that, I'll have to do the publication and get any conclusions from that in order to be able to answer that.
Those are the terms early. The 1,186 ships, did they have individual names?
No.
So it just said, this group of people brought this number of ships?
Yeah, it's 44 people with 175 places they came from. So it's just that. Thankfully, there is a name for each of them.
The two on my list. I think the catalogue of ships. I know we spoke about this earlier on in the year. Is sort of like, I think, a little neglected and overlooked. I mean, I might be wrong, but it's like all these long speeches in Nestor, we fall asleep a third of the way into it. Does anybody get to the end of it generally? I know I didn't. and I think it's great that it's going to open it up. What I was thinking about, something you said on quite early on, and of course it's the end product of an oral tradition, and you mentioned possibly local developments, local variations in the catalogue. Do you find there's any evidence for that in there? I'm thinking of scandal over, which was the guy, was it Pisistratus or something, the guy who changed it or something?
Yeah, it's,
so, yeah,
it's one of them. Because, for example, we get a very big, a lot of verses about Athens, and the Athenian leaders are non-existent in the rest of the Iliad.
Yeah.
And then we get two verses for Ajax, who is one of the big heroes, and it's just, and Ajax ships well together with the Athenian, and
the Athenians, yeah.
The end. There is nothing else. And there's a lot of things about Biotia, and actually the catalogue was called in antiquity Biotia, because there's a lot of information and a lot of localities from Biotia in the beginning, and they really didn't know why that happened, and they considered that probably a local poet wrote that part, and maybe Hesiod or whoever. And so there is evidence that there were local variations, probably written to honor the local heroes sometime in the past, before Homeric times, before Homer. And then this text came together and became and expresses in a way a new consciousness of the past, as I think it's Martin West's phrase, that the new consciousness of the past, how you build your tradition, how you create your identity using a heroic past and the literary tradition that stems from it.
Thank you, because a lot of it is, I guess, is clearly political. I mean, linking Ajax and Salamis with Athens,
yeah.
Political posturing on their part.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's great. I had to check my bibliography when Simpson came into a talk behind him.
More theoretical, it would be probably mostly that part, because in the end the big importance will be on the digital publication itself. What I will do is compile a complete bibliography of the catalog of ships itself, so this will be in the publication.
Were you thinking about loading the text of your dissertation as well? Or
yeah,
keep that aside for more prestigious publications?
No, altogether. Absolutely.
The questions are exactly the same. These catalogs do exist, but they are always incorrect. They are often treated as an interpolation which we can neglect.
Let's get to the next bit. Yeah. Well, I pointed to Chicago Homer, and I think that especially on the repetitions and on the formula, one can follow the text within the Chicago Homer and do that literary study. I will work more on the personal and place names. So, especially the Chicago Homer as a resource, where you can retrieve the text, have two translations on it, and then study all the formula and see if they are repeated in other epic poems. Of course, what would be great if the Chicago Homer was expanded to include all kinds of related epic literature from other cultures, for example, or if this prototype would include more ancient Greek literature, the rest of the corpus, in the way Perseus does or the TLG does. I mean, it would be really an evolution in classical studies if that happened.
Now, this is related a little bit to a question. The question I was going to ask. You've talked about how you're going to be linking various elements in this text to sites that exist, and whatever sites happen to be available have in some way steered you in that direction. And some of these sites, you say, are not entirely available in the way you'd like to. Did you have any, before you started working on this, did you have any ideas about the sorts of linking you would like to do if only such sites exist, or do you have any thoughts about that now? So you can link to various sites that do exist, but if you weren't constrained by the sites having to exist, what sorts of things would you like to be able to, what sorts of connections would you like to be able to make?
It would happen, but it can happen in a major dissertation. Maybe it could happen in a PhD. Mm-hmm. I would like to go and take pictures of all the place names we've read. Of course, I can't find them all because we don't know.
Sure, sure.
But definitely go there and do some field research on the places itself. It would be.
You probably will be able to find some sites that have those sorts of images. Mm-hmm. I can think of one or two people I know, you know, classics professors.
Yes, Metis.
They've taken lots of images. Yeah.
Related to that, I mean, one inevitable interpretive trap almost that you fall into when you're doing these things is, you know, the map of the Aegean up, you can plot all the names and everything. But of course, the author of the catalogue ship, authors of the catalogue ships, didn't have that map of the Aegean, they didn't have that image there. Do you have any thoughts on how you could almost work backwards from the catalogue to some kind of reconstruction of how worldview? I mean, you mentioned it could be a reference to an actual pre-Homeric world, for example. Do you have any views on how it fits into the kind of archaeological, the cognitive archaeology of the period? Mm-hmm. Fairly general question.
Yeah, the of course it's something that hasn't concluded as a subject, because we still don't know about all the places. We can identify them to actual places that exist in Greece. So, of course, a possibility would be that eventually they will be found, they will be excavated, as Troy was excavated 2 centuries ago, in Mycenae and so on. No, for the time being, I will focus on linking the places that can actually be identified as real places in the catalogue, because what I feel like what I need to do here is to give to people that don't have a classics background, probably, the linking to a real word, that I have a text in front of me, I might not understand the context, but the places I read about are real places, and the heroes I read about are not real people, but people that existed, and in a prospective study that would be more general and more expanded, it would be nice if every of the personal names in the catalogue would be linked to all the occurrences of the name in ancient Greek literature, so that you get a perspective, a diachronic perspective of that.
And in some ways, Stuart's question, I think, is one hinting at the fact that in some ways it's more. It would also be interesting to, in a sense, forget about the maps that we have and think about what this text, because this isn't a map; it's a text. What this text tells us about the what the world looked like to people who didn't have, they didn't have maps, because, you know, they never, you know, they couldn't take a satellite photo or whatever to even know what Greece looked like on a map. They what they had was places linked by journeys. So in a sense, it's an itinerary. It's you know, why are things in this order? How do they view the world? If you think of some of the ancient, the few ancient visual representations we do have of places, they don't look like maps in the way we imagine them. You know, that this is, you know, a very geographical piece of text.
And it has a consciousness on what it said, because the places are structured together. It's not just
right.
Achilles came and Agamemnon and
must anybody reading it must have all believed it. It must be plausible to the people who were reading it. Mm-hmm. And so when 100,000 men meet these taxes, an awful lot of people. But the readers must have felt over time, and the different authors must have didn't want to alter that. They were content to have those sort of numbers, which I think is quite astonishing. It would have been a huge enterprise, I mean, in realistic terms. Does that strike you?
It strikes me as something that, I don't know, of course, Homer was viewed as a historic source in ancient times, and they didn't. The questions about Homer, the questioning, and the critics came much, much later. Of course, Xenophanes was actually the first critic about Homer in 5th, 6th century BC. But actually, it was the basis of education, and it was thought of as a historic source. So even if there was a difference between what Homer said and what was the reality, they tried to explain. They found Strabo does that all the time, for example. And of course, I can't know if the numbers are actual, and I don't think they are. It's far too many people, far too many ships.
Yes.
But again, we can never know. I mean, it's. I don't consider the catalog of ships a documentary text. I give my emphasis on documentary kind of elements, but of course it's not it's a literary text, and a literary text can take liberties that a document cannot. So it's something
deeply myth making and deliberately stylistically superior. One word for ships in Greece at that time. So everything was a ship or not a ship. I mean, we have so many words for ships, ships, boats, all kinds of different kinds of vessels, maritime vessels.
I think that in the catalogue it's only naffs, so it's, I don't think there is a, I'm not sure, but I think it's only these words, so it can be 500 normal ships and 500 smaller or something, I don't think so.
This is just not that area that I was really interested in. I'm just a little bit discussing about literary tradition, and I think you mentioned that it's actually a moral tradition that exists. And so I was wondering if the Hesitus was also the word that would actually be to get a sense of the
tradition. You can get recordings of the Iliad, yes. There are. I don't have the links right now, but I can. But there are. Recordings, and I think a university in Austria has a whole site on how ancient poetry must have been read, and there are many recordings here, but I think you can find the recording of the whole first book of the Iliad, I think, somewhere.
We had a guy over a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, he was actually in King's, and he was giving a presentation in the big committee room, and he'd got he was from North America, and he had a lot of people using different regional accents and reciting chunks of poem again to get the effect of it all, to try and get back to what it would have sounded like. Do you remember who that was?
I was just wondering,
did
you suppose it was possible in a similar thing today to
find something. Does it have some, we can find some
device around the
world. Yeah, it's painless.
That'd be an interesting thought, I mean, that linking audio to this as well.
Mm-hmm.
That would be valuable.
If I can stick with the oral tradition again, again at the beginning, you mentioned that the formulaic nature of the poetry is very significant. It's very significant for the semantic effect, for the actual guy who's got to recite it from memory. How does that work in the catalogue? It must be extremely repetitious, yeah?
Yeah, all the time it's. This game, I don't have the text, but it is definitely, it's probably the best example of what I call from the late poetry. That happens, and that's what Wieser, in his commentary in 1997, noted, that actually in terms of although the catalogue is considered to be an older text, in terms of composition it can be a part of the Iliad integrally, and not something else. Later an interpolation. Let me see.
What is it? There's a tension coming together between two different traditions almost in this one text. Because on the one hand you have List, and you know, going back to the linear B tablets that you mentioned, of course, the Greeks and Proto Greeks of this period loved making lists, which the predominantly non-oral
people do.
Then you have this oral tradition coming on top of that. So that's quite an interesting sort of cultural or other, or it's two different motivations coming together in one particular type of
text. And it's the building of the heroic poetry in the time of its composition and for centuries afterwards, it's a building of an identity. It's
yes.
How they thought of themselves, how they thought of their past, how they understood the place they lived in, their culture. It was that kind
yes.
of this. Yes, it's over here actually, the first book, but I don't know if I can download it. That's the first book I need coming up. Any other questions?
The text as artifacts, what are the range of typologies you get for these?
For the catalog of ships or?
Papyrus?
There are many papyri on the catalog, heading text from the catalog. Did you ask that? I'm sorry, I didn't really. If you get it on inscribed on epigraphs, for example.
Okay, so papyrus. Is
you get papyri, you get lots of manuscripts of the Iliad as a whole, and you
sorry.
Get a lot of manuscripts, lots of manuscripts of the Iliad as a whole, and you get a lot of papyri as well in on the catalog of ships and some. Chunks of it, just two or three verses per papyrus, it's not too
much. And were you saying that you do have links too, that you have to see the archive?
I won't actually do that, but the Homer Multitext project will do it in time, which is a site that tries to create a critical edition of Homer, but in a digital form. So. There will be links from every verse to the manuscripts and to papyri readings of the verses, so that you can actually understand the involvement of the text. Because, according to the people in the project, the Homeric poems as an oral tradition kept on evolving when it wasn't anymore an oral tradition, it was written. So, this evolution can be understood. Can be seen in the text in the written versions of the Iliad, not only in what we can deduce happened before the first time they were written. The text evolved after it was written for the first time. It wasn't there wasn't a standard version that was the Bible and it's over. It kept evolving, it kept changing it through the time.
You kind of introduced it, I don't know to what extent it can be probably an interpretation of inscription. Is that how the actual bit of papyrus or what have you shapes, you know, exactly dimensions that can shape mm-hmm. what you can write, how often, you know, when you have to alter the text because you just run out of mm-hmm. certain writing surface, or do you see that scribes are sort of dipping the pen as, you know, to continue mm-hmm. to alter certain thoughts, so the actual writing process, and then how that actually shapes.
In Homer, you have some. You can't just do that because you have the meters that actually puts a limit on what you can do, and you have to keep at some standards because the text was very popular and known by many. It was a base of education, so you can't just change a verse or change a word because you run out of paper.
You're not comparing to actual
inscriptions
and seeing how they change over time based on what you're actually materially expressed or rendered to see if that process is actually.
And you don't really get Homer on inscriptions either, so it's.
Does the Homer and the papyri site link to images of the papyri? And if they link to the
Leuven database,
they will
link
to images.
The Leuven database links to images when they are available. They're available. It's not always, yeah.
Okay, so sometimes you might be able to get images.
But
an interesting question that occurs to me, I've never looked at related to this question is are these papyri? I mean, you mentioned that some of them are presumably text of the Iliad. Of which these are tiny fragments that remain, in which case they were writing an entire Iliad, and this just happens to be a little fragment that survived of it. But there are also texts which just cite the Iliad, and that's an interesting question related to this. You know, in what context was it cited? Was it cited in the context of a literary text?
And the papyri is a non-literary, so it's
right, a commentary, or if someone may write a letter and they would quote a line from the Iliad in it, or what sort of context in which it might be cited. And there must have been objects on which would have been written a line or a group of lines from the Iliad and nothing else, or at least nothing else immediately around it, so not necessarily quoting it in a passage of prose or whatever, but it must have just had text, and that would certainly be interesting to see the shape of the object, the shape of the text, and that sort of thing. And I'm sure there must, I mean, I know there are magical papyri that recommend you write certain lines from the Iliad or the Odyssey on objects for religious and protective purposes and whatever.
Came across,
so we must have some objects. We must have gemstones. Yeah. We've got hundreds of inscribed gemstones.
You can get actually, in Athens I was working on literary ostraca, and you can get Homeric ostraca, and in that case it might just be two or three words of Homer, or it might be an entire library.
Yeah.
Actually, I came across an entire library with the two first books in ostraca.
Yeah.
So it was.
Do you know if we have any amulets or similar objects with lines of Homer on?
No, I was thinking we basically know Homer from medieval manuscripts
and
papyrus scraps and fill that out, but this is why we can't really, I think, usefully study much. We have medieval manuscripts that give us the whole text. They're very similar, and then the papyri that are also very, very similar, about, a thousand years or more earlier to the medieval text. So it's pretty clear that they were fixed early on, and there's not much mileage in studying change over time. There will have been change over time much earlier, but then we don't have any written approach.
The variation doesn't necessarily have to feed back into the tradition. We may still have texts from the 3rd century, but there can still be variants that lead off into dead ends that are interesting in their own right, the way in which people might have adapted it one-off on objects.
Well, there were apparently in I think the city. The standard text. People obviously argue about this, but the standard text is supposed to have been one created in Athens in the late 6th century. But apparently there was a city. Individual cities had their own version, slightly different from the standard one. So there was that. This was being in the 6th century.
Yeah.
So when you say a city would have it, I mean, it literally was the authorities in the city that would have it done.
So it's, well, I mean, I think what we know is that, you know, some traditions say that there is the Alexandrian version or the Basilian version, whether that's, you know, municipal copy or just something that was that circulated with people. I don't think we know.
Any other questions, comments, or observations? Perhaps then we should let Yanis off for a moment and move to a more informal part of this. We'll continue discussing informally over the wine and nibbles, I think. But can we thank Yanis one more time?